just do 7 and then we'll talk about something else, and then we'll start the Gita. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryankaravavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Mavitvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I'm teaching this class at school. It's an advanced seminar, and we've just started where the students are starting to give their own presentations. It's on Jung in the East, but I teach the first half of the course, and then after that, they have to present. And so I have one student in the class, his name's David King Keller. And he has been working on this technique called micro-mindfulness. And he's a very, very interesting guy. But he's very seriously been working and doing research on this particular technique, and it's kind of like a 30-second meditation that is based upon, there's a lot of science involved and a lot of research has been done about these certain things. And some of these, there's three different things, and research has been done on each of these three different things in terms of being able to absorb and quieten the mind. And very positive research on these three, but he has put these three together in kind of a 30-second meditation. And so I'm going to guide us on this, but let me talk about it first, because I'd like you to just try it, and I might get a little more sophisticated with it just so you can see how it is, because I thought it's kind of interesting. They have found that even for people in the workplace, if every 2 hours you let the people just stop working, stand up and take six deep breaths in and out, it exponentially increases their productivity. Just that one simple thing, to take six deep breaths. I'll show you how to do that in a minute. How he does it, and I think how the research has done that. Then there's another technique that has to do with right side, left side brain, of the brain, using your hands and visualization. And what he does is he uses, imagine on your both fingers, both hands, on this finger, on each tip of each finger, you're using the red, green, the green, yellow, and red of the stoplight, right? If you imagine a green light on each finger, and you go like this, right? That green means going ahead, means your mind. As you do, you're imagining green and you're going like this. Your mind then is the go-ahead to just keep flowing. The thoughts are just keeping flowing like traffic. Mind's just flowing, so you get the green like that. It's one. Then you imagine yellow. As you do that, now the mind, the thoughts are slowing down because it's yellow. Okay? And then you imagine red. And now as you do that, more like this, you don't have to handle more like this, it could be like anything. As you do like that, then the mind, that red brings the mind to a complete relaxation, a complete stop. Then after you've done that, so they've did studies on this also, I forget what it's called, it's some sort of, it's not neuro-linguistic programming, but it's something like that. Then after that, having done six breaths and then doing this little exercise. And then after that, you sit holding your hands like this. You sit like that. And you just let a smile come to your face, like a Mona Lisa smile or the smile of the Buddha. Just. And you just hold that for a while. So what they do is this is what he's developing and doing research on, is that he himself is doing it every 2 hours or so. just to see what it does to the, because it's just a mindfulness practice. The difference is it's a micro mindfulness practice that you do for 30 seconds, you know, or 20 seconds or however long it takes you to go through that process. And from the studies so far, it actually is very, very effective. I thought it was really interesting. It's so simple, you know, it's so, so simple. And so anyway, they're bringing some science into all of this, how the neurons are working and all this type of thing. So you want to try it? You ready to try
sure.
it? But you have to stand up.
Okay. We can do that.
Yeah, because no, I just want to see. I just want to see what you think of this. I told him I was going to try, I was going to teach you this. Okay. When he does the six breaths, three in, you're going to roll your shoulders like this for each one, like this. For each one, okay? And then when we do the next three, the last three, you're going to go the opposite direction, okay? You ready? Okay. In a comfortable position, imagine the tip of your index finger as having a green light on it, and just bring it to your thumb, like a mudra, chin mudra that we know. Open it. Imagine the same finger now as a yellow light. Close. Open. And now imagine the same finger as a red light. Close. Keep it closed. And now let yourself have a gentle smile, like the Buddha smile or the Mona Lisa.
And this is every 2 hours? Is that the most efficacious of it? Playing
around? That's just what he's playing around with. But the thing is just to, I mean, for me, it really works, actually. I find it very absorbing. So when we were talking, what I was telling him was some of the things that we do. I'm really doing this for Michael because he asked this stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Some of the things that we do, and I was telling you, we were discussing this in the class, is you don't want to use this, which I think is actually very effective for just relaxing the body and the mind, absorbing the mind. You don't want to forget about doing that type of inner child work or to the inner child work where you have that ongoing kind of dialogue with different parts inside, especially if you're having a reaction of things. Sometimes if that reaction grabs you, you know, it's nice to acknowledge it and have some sort of inner child work, like, tell me what's really going on, tell me what's really bothering you. That tends to transform the mind and those parts inside, just by being present. It's like being a good friend to your mind. That's absolutely, I think, for kind of a long-term antakarana shuddhi, for long-term gaining a mind that has natural shanti, natural peacefulness, having that type of relationship with your unconscious or your reactions, not taking the reactions always to be real in the terms that it's this person's fault that I'm having this reaction or this person has done this to me. You get into the habit of dealing with your reactions differently instead of immediately taking the other as the one who's responsible for your pain, but going directly to the pain itself and saying, what's really wrong, what's really bothering you, what's really hurting you. You're kind of like a good parent or a good mother or a Swami, the Swami, the teacher, when you do that, you know. But instead of immediately going out, you go in to where the hurt actually is. You can blame this person out here, but the hurt is in here. If the hurt's not out there, the hurt is in here. And so by letting your mind, your buddhi, go and be present to the hurt, where the hurt actually is, and talk to it. Say, what's really bothering you? And let that hurt itself talk and tell you what's really bothering you. Usually what it has to say can be very different than what's actually going on out here and how you may be responding on a level of, say, if you're responding on a level of anger, for instance. Anger is very superficial. Anger is just something that's a cover-up for an inner hurt. So it's better just to go inside and say, okay, what is it really? And then to be a good parent to that part inside. So this isn't at all to negate or bypass that type of work. Because otherwise the unconscious, the little ones inside, just build up, you know. But so that type of inner work you have to keep doing, and it just becomes natural to you. Where you don't, but it stops the whole projection. You're just dealing with yourself so that you can be an objective person in the world, and at the same time you're taking care of the parts inside that are wounded. Right? Okay, so
still only 30 seconds?
No. This 30-second thing is something else. It's just by itself. But what I'm trying to say is that little 30-second exercise is just very powerful in its own right. You don't want to use it to bypass this other type of work, that's all. Because the unconscious will then keep reacting. You know how to assuage it. This little 30-second exercise kind of wipes out the whole problem. But what I'm saying is that whole problem will keep coming unless you kind of do that inner work. But a little exercise like this, it wipes out totally the perseveration, where the mind is just circling around some sort of problem, building up on some sort of problem, feeling down or not having enough energy, or he has a whole list, like feeling low self-esteem. He has all of these things, low self-esteem, low self-worth, feeling no energy, you know, depleted, burnt out, all of these type of feelings that the mind can get into. An exercise like this just re-energizes the mind and relaxes it totally, so those type of feelings are not there, and they go away. And I think they do. I think it has a lot of merit, and there's hundreds of these type of things. This is just one that this fellow's working on. It's got some science behind it. I have some articles on it I can show you. But what's interesting to me is that there are things that really work to relax your mind. You just have to relax your mind and absorb your mind. There's a transition people have to go through. And it goes something like this. It becomes more important to you to have that depth of shanti than to feel entitled to your anger. What I mean by that is we can feel justified. We can feel justified in our hurt and justified in our anger, because this person did this to me, or the world did this to me, you know. Or somebody did this to me, the job did this to me. It's not fair, it's unjust, this person is a bad person. He deserves my anger, you know, as though my anger is useful. He deserves my hatred. He deserves my anger. You know, I'm not going to let him get away with this, so I'm going to be hurt and I'm going to be angry. We have a value for that. There's a justification. It seems like the right thing to do, to be hurt and to be mad and to be angry. But there does come a time for you when that really is not worth it.
You mean to pick Shanti instead of drama?
Yes. But it's not even picking. It's picking Shanti, that Shanti, loving the Shanti more than the drama. Where the drama and the self-righteousness and the, you know, wanting to make sure that to be angry and hurt and have somebody pay, all of that type of stuff, that whole level, you know, of reality is no longer worth it to you. This is all part of really being a mumukshu. You say, what really is worth it to me is the Shanti, or knowing myself, or being able to have the, to be with myself, where the Ananda actually is. So that's a transition, right? Where I choose that Ananda over the self-righteous anger. By self-righteous anger, I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean this person has done something wrong. This person has done something wrong, and they have. They have done something wrong. They have done something hurtful. The world has done something wrong. The world has done something hurtful. I have to be hurt and show my hurt and have some sort of revenge, etc., all of this. We have a value for it, you know, and feel justified in it. There comes a time when you don't think that way anymore. You don't want to deal with the world in that way. You want your mind to enjoy the Shanti of your own being, really, and then deal with the world objectively. The great thing, one of the great things about, this is what knowledge does for you. What self-knowledge does for you is it takes the projection of Ananda on the world and gives it back to yourself. The Ananda, or the joy, the love, the fullness that's been projected onto the world because of self-ignorance is re-owned as your own very swarup, as your own very nature. And so now that you see clearly, you understand it in contemplation and in class, you recognize the truth of it, you know, no doubt, but your mind continues to, because of just habitual ignorance, because of habitual habits, it continues to project that Ananda out onto the world and then act like a samsari, basically. I need this to be happy and this person's getting in my way, etc. The whole thing gets projected out. And then you will get caught and drown in that for a while. And then, you know, pull your mind back. You know, it happened again. You pull your mind back. There comes a time for a while when it happens. You're in it. You feel justified. And that the tension of that has to drop off before you get enough shanti to then say something like, wow, that was a wild ride. But while you're in it, it's very, very real and it's very painful. And you feel justified in it. Then you finally pull it back and you realize you're happy that you're out of it. But there comes a time where it just simply is not worth it to you to go through all of this. It's not worth it because you know the truth of the whole thing, and you've been with the truth of the whole thing for long enough that you don't want your mind to go through this type of thing anymore. And so then, before it even starts, you start to pull it back. You know? If you're feeling hurt or down, instead of blaming all of the world, you go inside to see what is really the problem. Because the problem is inside. You know? That's a big thing to see. But once you know that the problem is inside, then you can talk to that pain, and then you can do some of these meditative techniques. This is one of them. This is just a little simple 30-second meditation that they've done a lot of work on. So whether a person's spiritual or not, doesn't make any difference. These things are very helpful in just quietening the mind. It's a technique. Pranayama is a technique. You don't have to be spiritual. we use it. You know, we use it for our own shanti. But, a jock could be using it. Or they could, you can use it in the office. Because it works. Because it's science. The mind and the breath are connected. They have a relationship with each other. And so if you affect one, the other is affected. So just like if your mind is very upset about something, your breathing will be off. You can be hyperventilating because you're so upset, you're hyperventilating. So if you know that that relationship is there, which in India, it's such an ancient tradition, they do know. They have all types of breathing techniques in order to control and absorb the mind. Because the mind can affect the breath, but the breath affects the mind. So say that you know this. Here they're just doing a very simple one, also using the body to relax the body at the same time. Six breaths, six very deep breaths. Because that affects the mind in a very positive way. There's all other kinds of breathing techniques also, all of which affect and absorb the mind. So say, as you gain knowledge and your mind continues to act like it doesn't have knowledge, which is how it is, there's an emotional lag time, then as you gain a value, and that, now, we say as you gain that value is really what we call vairagya. Vairagya, sometimes translated as dispassion, vairagya, in the end, is knowledge. Vairagya and knowledge go together. What makes, if you have vairagya, the person who has total vairagya has knowledge, self-knowledge. What makes a person a mumukshu, one who desires liberation, is they recognize half of the picture in terms of vairagya. What they recognize is that it is absolutely impossible in this world, with this body, with these sense organs, with these mind, with any mind, with any sense organs, with any body, with the world as it is, by its nature, it is impossible for me to gain any type of lasting wholeness or fullness. It's not possible at all, because everything in the world is continually changing, it's continually subject to birth and death and to change. And so I can't stop the world at a moment of happiness to be able to say, now everything is as it should be. And this is not possible. I don't know why it takes countless beginningless lifetimes to come to that rather obvious realization. But it does. It takes forever to come to that realization. Because what happens is our mind tricks us. We get into a situation where if only I could have this, I would be happy. And then you get it and you are happy. This is the trick. You get it and you are happy. So it's true. But 15 seconds later, or 30 seconds later, the next desire comes and it says, yeah, but I need this too. So then you say, okay, well, if I had this too, then I would be happy, because when I got this, I was happy. And so if I had this too, yes, then that's what it would take to make me happy. But this goes on forever. And at some point you realize, you put two and two together and you realize that that doesn't work. And so that you're always running after happiness in a world in such a way that you can never succeed. Not because you're deficient, but because it doesn't exist. That type of success doesn't exist. It won't happen because of the nature of the changing nature of the world and of you and of your mind. You don't even keep wanting the same thing. So you gain this. This is a vairagya that actually makes you into a mumukshu. Why it makes you into a mumukshu is because desiring liberation is because you can't liberate yourself from that problem. Right? There's nothing you can do to fix that problem. Otherwise, you were not going to be a mumukshu because you would think, well, if I just did this and this and this, I would be fine. It would be fine. If I got rid of this person, if I got rid of this irritant, if I gained this and I gained that, then life would be fine. I would be happy. If you think that, you're not a mumukshu. A mumukshu is the one who has recognized that actually I can't fix it and neither can anybody else. And so that if there is a solution, then you kind of throw your hands up to Ishwara. If you're there, is there any solution to this problem? Because I am incapable of finding a solution, not because of any lack of myself, but because of the nature of the creation. That's what makes you somebody who desires liberation, because you're put into kind of the dark night of the soul. You're put into that situation where you realize that you cannot solve this problem. And it's like saying, what I need as a human being, I can't have. And so then, how could that be? I need breath and there's air. You know, I need liquid, I need water to survive, and there's water. I need food, and there's food. But this very fundamental need that all human beings have, not just me, but all beings have, you know, there's no solution to this problem. It doesn't make sense that there's no solution to it, especially when I experience it. Because at moments of happiness, you do experience it, and you do say, this is how it's supposed to be. This is who I am. Now, why does it keep slipping away? Why does it slip away? This is the truth. It's not like we don't know. It's not like we haven't experienced it. We just don't know where it is or how to get it. So when you realize that you can't solve this problem in terms of the things that you can do, then you become a mumukshu. You have vairagya now toward the world because you realize it can't give you what you need, but you don't have the vairagya based upon the accomplishment of the problem. You have vairagya, you've got dispassion, based upon this won't make me happy, but you don't have the dispassion based upon I am happy. See, if I am happy, then this can be here or not be here, because my happiness is not dependent on it. That's vairagya. That's the culmination of vairagya. I am happy, and nothing can take that away from me, so these things can come and go in my happiness. It doesn't take my happiness away. That's the culmination of vairagya. It starts out with, this world cannot give me what I seek. And it resolves into, I am the very ananda that I seek, and it's not subject to change. That vairagya is there. As we assimilate our knowledge. But there's a distance between this world is not going to make me happy and the recognition of my own self as the source of that, right? And so my mind has spent lifetimes after lifetimes after lifetimes trying to get some shanti out here. Mm. Create a situation that will really make me happy. And we do it on so many levels, so many subtle levels, you know. But there comes a time as you become kind of mindful of the way that your mind is kind of reliving these old patterns, you start to pull the mind back in. And then these techniques start to matter to you, like going to the pain instead of going out to the situation and blaming the situation. You go to the pain itself. And the pain inside is going to have multi-levels, but one level is there's a little child inside who had their feelings hurt when you were 2 or 3 years old, and that's being triggered. That's one level. So in talking to the little child, you have to acknowledge that level and take care of it on the level of, you know, it's okay, you're fine, and I understand how you feel, but you're going to be fine. You have to say whatever is relevant to that part of it. There's another level, which is now that you have knowledge, you know, after you take care of the little child level, there's the level of bringing your mind back to what you know to be true, you know. The ananda that you're seeking from this particular situation doesn't exist there. The ananda exists in your own being. That's a knowledge level. Bringing that knowledge in is great. That's very helpful. But these are all verbal things. They're all cognitive. And they help. They help a lot. They're cognitive and emotional, right? They're a cognitive way of dealing with the emotional problem. But then there's also, in addition to this, there's these little techniques, you know, pranayama, japa, the repetition of a mantra. You know, I say always do these emotional ones first to bring the unconscious into let the unconscious feel loved. The little ones inside, let them feel loved, to be feel understood. That's important. But then these other techniques are powerful. Breathing, even breathing into a count of four and exhaling to a count of four. Very powerful for quietening the mind. Japa, the repetition of a mantra, knowing how to do the japa, quietens the mind. This little 30-second meditation, 30 seconds, it wipes out some of the stress in the mind, just clears it right out. You know? So we gain a value for doing these type of, for utilizing this type of knowledge of how to handle the mind, how to bring the mind back into a state of shanti, into being with myself. See, even to say that, how to bring the mind back into just some peace, just to be with myself, that means you have a self to be with. I think that was the wonderful thing about Vedanta, is now you have a self to be with. But your mind is trained to act in the opposite way. And so you use contemplation, this little 30-second meditation, pranayama, japa, inner child work, all of these things to bring the mind back into just a relaxed position. All the while knowing that the ananda that you're seeking is your own being. It doesn't exist out here. We never look at any ananda out here. We look at the ananda. Oh, look at that happiness. It's not out there. We never experience it out there. We only experience it as my own being, really. And if we think we're experiencing out there like somebody else is smiling and happy, that's what you're experiencing. Well, look, they're smiling, they're happy. You know, I want to be smiling and happy like that. But those are only lingas. They're only qualities that you're seeing and then you're attributing. You know, when a person smiles, they're happy. Yeah. But the experience of happiness is always internal, not external. Yeah. It's always, I am happy. It's my own being. And so the mind gets into dispositions which are like dark clouds in a sense. And so we have to learn how to work with that mind, bring it back home continually. Okay. So that's kind of a general understanding of how to deal with the mind. Then we have these techniques. I just listed a whole bunch of them. One, this Pratipakshabhavana, is how many thousands of years old is that? I mean, it's thousands, literally thousands of years old, like japa and these things. That means they've stood the test of time, some of these things. Pratipakshabhavana is important because when you come to knowledge, you're bringing a lot of baggage with you. You know, you're bringing a lot of likes and dislikes with you. You know? And you can have a lot of hurts and a lot of hatreds. But the problem is, again, when you have a hurt or a hatred or a disgust, that is inside. It's not outside. So you can't say, oh, look at the disgust over there, you know, or look at there's some hatred over there. It's not. It's all of it is inside of you. And something, someone has triggered it. Right? For some reason. That person has triggered it for some reason. It's because there's a trigger inside of you and that trigger's been touched off. But you're the one who's carrying that pain. Nobody else. And that's when, you know, Swamiji says, keep everybody outside. What happens is they come inside. When you're carrying that tremendous pain inside, they may not be carrying it at all. But they're taking up this one Lukoff, this Fred Lukoff, he's a psychologist, he says, it's taking up too much real estate. These people, their problems with the, you know, they're taking up so much real estate inside. All of your space, all of your inner space they're taking up. It's not worth it. You know? And so that takes some real, like a realization. It's a realization that this pain, this dislike, this hatred, this hurt, this anger is inside. It's not outside. It is inside. And I have to deal with it inside. We think dealing with it outside helps. There are certain things, like the Pratipaksha Bhavana, that help to break that pain inside. You know, but I have to be dealing with the pain inside. You know, like I tell that story of that woman years ago that was causing so much pain for me. You know, and she had her problems. I mean, it's not like she was some saint and I was just projecting on her. So she had her problems, but why should I be so hurt by it? Why should it be such a problem for me? There's a lot of problematic people in the world. You know, and so I could do some physical action to stop it by just going up and saying hello. And just a simple thing, going up and saying hello. That's a physical action that was able to break that internal pain. But you have to do something like that. You have to have a reason. You have to realize that the pain is something that I'm suffering inside, and this is a technique to break it. Then you're willing to do it. Right? And it works also. Or say you have a dislike for somebody and you do a Pratipaksha Bhavana, you just offer them internally, you offer them a flower, internally you talk to them, internally you have a dialogue with them, you know. Because you don't have a value for having that hatred inside. Because you know it's inside.
And it takes up too much real estate.
And it sounds simple, but you know we're trapped in this. We get trapped in all of this kind of stuff, where I feel justified, or this person did that to me. This person did that to me, and so I hate her, or whatever. And I feel, and of course I hate her because look at what she did. You know what I mean? So I'm willing to, because I'm justified. I feel justified because it's such an evil person or whatever that I almost want to hold on to my anger or my hatred or my rage. When you start thinking about it, it makes no sense. Then you can feel, but if I don't have my hatred and if I don't have my rage, she or he's going to get away with it then. They'll get away with it. And actually the one who's suffering terribly is you. And so there comes a time when the world just doesn't matter in terms in that way of retribution. What matters is that you free yourself from the pain that you're carrying around inside. Because of the source of the ananda is not out there anyway. Right? It's not out there anymore.
So the source of the ananda is not out there anyway. And I'm
wondering... It never has been.
Is ananda mean something different than the kind of happiness that comes when things are going great, something great happens and you're happy?
No, when things are going great and you're happy, the reason that you're happy, the experience of happiness has for its source only the Atma, only the Self. What's allowing for the mind to feel that I am happy is that when there's such a situation that allows the mind to relax, it becomes like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun. And so this, then I say it's a lover, say it's a relationship or something, that you're in love with somebody and they make you so happy because when you're with them and they're acting in just the right way, of course. Right. Then your mind is relaxed and you feel so happy. And now say you're in, at a party with a bunch of friends and you're having a great time and everybody is relaxed and happy. It's because their mind is relaxed. There's no tension. There's no tension in the mind. It's like a clear water bucket reflecting the sun. And those are what we call, and in this Vedanta they'll call, this is a little sukhalesha. Sukha means happiness. It's just a little lesha, just a little touch of sukha. Because all it is the mind for that moment is relaxed. Whereas all the while, your very being, which is the self of that relaxed mind and the self of the tense mind, is an enduring ananda that never comes and goes. For a jnani, for somebody who has knowledge, the enduring ananda, changeless ananda of your own being, is what the mind is always enjoying. Because that differentiation has been made. In fact, for somebody, when you have that clarity of knowledge, as you become clear, that fullness is ever present. It doesn't really matter what your mind is doing. You can have an agitated mind or an unhappy mind or a happy mind. It doesn't matter at all because your being is ever present. It's been differentiated. But because then for jnani, because the fullness of your being is recognized, then these upset, which are just because of agnanam, really, it's just habitual. You can just easily bring the mind back to your own being because your being is there. You just bring the mind back. It's just natural, like breathing, kind of, because that differentiation is there. And the mind knows the only thing that's causing me pain right now is my stress. Why bother? Just relax. That's how the mind, it doesn't want to become unnecessarily stressed or strained. Why should it? When I can just relax and be with myself and everything is fine. Then I can be with you as problematic as you may be or as joyful as you may be. And I'm fine. Or you can be a monstrous person. But I haven't taken you inside because I'm not superimposing my ananda on you. Right? It's all illusion that really causes the mind to become very upset. Are you following me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I
find it much easier to follow the part about the upset and that than the part about the ananda being projected externally.
It's think of it, the ananda is an experience that you have. Okay, everyone does. At times, not all the time. But you do have experiences of happiness. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you have an experience of happiness, you look around and see what the situation is. Now I'm happy, and it's because of you. Because of how you are. Because your relationship with me. That's why I'm happy. And so therefore, I need you so that I can be happy. Because you are the carrier of the happiness. That's a projection. I think because you're there and I'm happy, you have made me happy. So you are giving me the happiness. I don't realize that the ananda, that experience of well-being, really all that it requires is the mind to relax. It has nothing to do with you or with the world or with anything else. But until I know that, then if somebody makes me happy, in other words, if the two go together in some situation and I feel happy, then I look, okay, you're the source of that happiness, so I need you. The situation is the source of that happiness, so I need that situation. That's projection. It's superimposition. I superimpose the experience of a happiness onto all the nama rupas, the name and whatever situation I'm experiencing. So I have the experience of happiness, and then I have the situation I find myself in. So the ananda gets superimposed onto the situation. Then I say, I have to keep this situation so that I can keep my happiness. I have to keep this person so I can keep my happiness. I have to keep this job so I can keep my happiness. That's superimposition.
The thing is, those different situations lead to a different kind of happiness for me. I mean, there's some qualitative difference.
Lots of qualitative differences.
And intensity is different.
Yes,
too.
Oh yeah. It's countless, endless. Endless qualitative difference, but think of it like this. Say there's a spectrum from this on, here's the middle, and then we have a spectrum. Mm-hmm. On this side of the spectrum, there's a certain level of relaxation with a lot of different variants and changes and intensities. Relaxed, and did more and more relaxed, and then just totally, extremely relaxed. So these are all varieties of love, varieties of ananda. All of them have to do, though, with a mind that enjoys some type of relaxation. Same with the negative spectrum. A little bit of irritation, a little bit of dullness, a little bit of dislike. These are all different levels until you get into dark depression and hatred. They're all different levels of stress, of tension, you know, of constriction in the mind and the body. So if you relax the constriction, the feeling goes away. We think that the hatred or that these negative experiences are they also are superimposed onto the situation. They're not. You can actually be in the same situation, and actually we experience this. We don't necessarily realize it, but sometimes you can be in a situation with a person who you have at some time extreme dislike, extreme hatred for. You're the one who's feeling the hatred inside, the dislike. You can be with that very same person in another situation, you're not feeling that at all. It's the same with a person, that person can be a person, thing, anything. You can be with a person and you're feeling so much joy, so much love in the presence of that person. Another time, you're not feeling anything. Another time, you're feeling irritated. You know? Poor person. They can be just the same. You know?
Well, doesn't the fact that there are these qualitative differences, both on the positive and the negative side, it seems to suggest to me that there is something on the outside that's affecting the nature of the happiness.
I would say there's something in the relationship, what you're superimposing onto that person, that causes the mind to be relaxed or stressed in a particular way. And that's what causes the difference. Now just imagine, like on this, what if my mind has actually discovered the source of the ananda, the source of the happiness? Because all of us know, even with a slight bit of analysis, that in fact the experience of ananda really can't belong to any object, because sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. So we really know that. Mm-hmm. But we also know that the experience of ananda is real and is absolutely meaningful. Ananda, I mean wholeness, fullness, love, whatever it were. And I want that. I want that. It's not a made-up experience. It's very real. So where is it? Where is it located? Because it's really not in the object, right? And it's not in the object, it's in my desire for the object. Well, the desire for the object can be very irritating. So it's not in the desire for the object, it's in the fulfillment of the desire for the object. Like, say, I want you to be in a particular way. I love you when you're in this way. You're in this way right now, and I want you to be in this way right now. All of these things are coming together. And then I experience that love. But really, what is happening is when all of these things are coming together in just the perfect way, fulfilling my desire, because all the things could come together in the perfect way, but I'm not desiring it at that time, then it doesn't matter. So my desire and the object has to all come together in the perfect way, and then at that moment, I am desireless. At the moment, because the desire has been fulfilled. When I am desireless, then I have a pure shantavritti. Just like the water bucket reflecting the sun. Now my mind is not in any way an obstruction. It's like a clear water bucket. And the ananda that reflects in that mind in a way that's very pleasing to me. But what I start, as I understand all this, there's still more to go here. There's another step that needs to be taken. I understand that my mind, when it is, a desire has been filled, it is shanti, it has peace. When a desire is fulfilled, at that moment I don't want anything. Well, there are many, many situations that can make my mind quiet. I could be meditating, I could be walking in nature, I could be doing pranayama. And there's many, many ways of relaxing the mind, making the mind quiet. That's why when we do meditation, you can have great shanti. When you walk in nature, you can have great shanti. You know, when it's the smile of a child, you can have great shanti. It's because your mind relaxes. So what if I realize that actually it's the desirelessness or the relaxation of the mind that gives me peace? And there are many, many ways to do that. It's not just fulfilling a desire. I can quiet the mind in many ways. And then now on top of that, what if I recognize what is actually the source of the ananda is my own being, which is changeless? Then there's no distance between the mind and my being at all. There's no distance. The mind enjoys me completely. And so now the mind just relaxes, enjoys relaxing into my own ananda. That's what it does. It relaxes into my own ananda instead of doing the circuitous route of going out here, desiring something and having to work to fulfill the desire so that I can have a shantavritti, a moment of desirelessness, where I can say, ah, so happy. But it only lasts for a moment. That is exactly samsara.
So what should be the thought process there?
Until as you gain knowledge, your mind becomes dependent on your own being for its ananda, and then happily it enjoys the world. That's the difference. I enjoy the source of ananda, and enjoying the source of ananda, then I experience Ishvara. But I don't ask the world to make me happy. I happily experience Ishvara. I happily experience the world.
Is that a different kind of... I mean, is the nature of that kind of ananda more calm and peaceful mm-hmm. and kind of quiet, as opposed to, say, you know, someone who might be very happy with this loud party and there's dancing and loud music
yeah.
and they're doing drugs and drinking and, you know, there's this kind of...
The ananda of the self is subtle. It's always there. It's changeless. The quiet mind enjoys that fullness quietly. The agitated, frenetic mind that has that calm, like a party mind, enjoys that, but there's all gets bubbly like champagne or something. Those are all types of vrittis, but there's a relaxation. There's not the tension in those vrittis, like at a party, for instance. There's not tension there. You know, there's relaxation, but exuberance.
Mm-hmm.
But the self is always the same. And the self is there to be recognized even in a dukkha vritti. Not in the quality of the vritti, of the thought, but as the very being, the one, the me that is present there. And so the mind becomes in love, in a sense, with that the ananda of just the me, of the conscious being. It recognizes it, that it's always there, it's never not there. And then it becomes more and more and more relaxed because it's not asking the world to be in a certain way so that I can be happy. That's why, you know, Jivan Mukta, I mean, somebody who's really mature in their knowledge, you can trust being around them, because they're not asking, their wholeness isn't dependent upon how you are. It's dependent upon the self. And so they're not going to be unstable. Whereas a samsari is quite unstable. They may be stable person within samsara, but they're quite unstable because they're dependent upon things being in a particular way so that they can get a shantavritti, so that they can be happy. Whereas a jnani is not dependent on that. A jnani is dependent, the mind is dependent upon the source of happiness, which is never is invariable, never changes.
So nidha dhyasana would be just like resting in that and enjoying it. And it's something that can be done anytime. Even during activity.
Even during activity.
Or whatever.
Absolutely.
And
That's right.
Well, if you absorb yourself into your own nature, what do you say to the mind that has the depression? And I mean, there's...
You say... you talk to it. That's what I would do. Like, tell me what's really bothering you, what's really hurting you, why are you feeling so down? Let it talk a little bit. Mm. You'd be like a loving parent. Mm. And then you can, after you've done that, then you can bring in your knowledge, then you can do nididhyasana. But first you have to acknowledge, because that's acknowledging the unconscious. The depression and all of these things, it's usually an unconscious phenomenon, you know, needs some attention. And the attention isn't really out here. The attention should be to the one where the depression is, where the hurt is, where the anger is. You know, but we tend to, say you feel depressed, for instance, feeling so depressed, then you look up at the world, this world sucks. You know, it's because of this and because of this and because this happened to me and this happened to me, that's why I'm depressed. But in doing that, no one's paying any attention to the depression. Nobody's talking to the one who's depressed. It's all just blaming this and blaming that and blaming that for it, but no one's taking care of the problem. Right? Whereas if you go into the problem, which is there inside, and then you say, you know, tell me what's really going on, what's bothering you, let that part really talk, and you can be a good parent or a good guide. You know, like Swamiji says, friend, philosopher, and guide. You be a good guide, a friend. Part of the problem internally is that we can get isolated, internally isolated. You have no friend inside, no Swamiji inside, no one who...
Nobody cares for me.
Yeah. Then you're just alone. You know, so you learn how to bring the part, the caring part in. Because the Atma, the self, is always there. It's not like what is absolute care, the absolute truth of the whole universe is all there, your being. So it's not away. It's not away from you. And so that healing part is really the core of your being. And that part can always soothe. You know, the buddhi identified with that part can soothe the part that is depressed or who is hurt or is worried. And the more clarity you have, the more that you can do that. Even in terms of, say, if you look into your future, well, what's going to happen now and what's going to happen now and I don't know what to do here and what's going to happen to me. As you become more understanding, you can say things and know what you mean. You can say, let Ishwara take care of it. Don't worry about it. But that's not flippant. Mm-hmm. It's real. You can really say that. See how Ishwara takes care of it. You don't have to carry the burden of the future, which you just do what you need to do in the present.
Well, if you don't carry the burden, who's going to carry it?
Ishwara. That's knowledge. Mm. Really, that was it. For me, even though maybe I knew that and knew that and knew that and knew that.
Yeah.
In so many ways. At one time when Swamiji said, just at the right time, he said, I just do what's in front of me it moment to moment to the best of my ability. And that's it. And that's what he said. And I realized that is it. That's the truth of it. What is, you do what's in front of you to be done to the best of your ability, and life goes on. That, the thing is, this is what you're doing anyway, whether you realize it or not. You're doing moment to moment to moment what is there to be done. That's all you can do. And then the next moment comes, and the next moment comes, and the next moment comes. So it's actually, it's a bit, just to think like that is a sadhana. And you see the truth of it, it's like, it's exactly what you're doing anyway. But the problem is our mind creates this horror story that we can be of worry and all of these type of things that is not doing anything. It's just in the ether. It's doing something in the ether to make me miserable.
Well, it's about to happen.
Yeah, but it's not, right? It's imaginal.
Yeah.
But it's not about to happen. It's imaginal. You don't know what's about to happen. So you have to rein in this, what we call catastrophic thinking. You have to rein in the catastrophic thinking. And if you're going to have any type of imaginal thinking, make it be good. where you get some pleasure out of it.
And relaxation.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Even, and that's another thing. If you find yourself doing this catastrophic thinking, this horror story full of worry and fear and dread, what's going to happen, If you can notice that with the value, and understanding, you notice it and say, hey, let's change this imagination. And then put a good one out there. But you have to have a value for that, and you have to realize that you're really out there in la-la land. It is not real. It's not real at all. So you can say, okay, that's not real, and it's hurting me. Let's pull it back, and I have a good one. What's the good, instead of being in the dark, shadowy side, let's look to the future in a positive way and have that type of energy. Or just be in the present. See, these things, they're things to notice because the mind so habitually does this type of stuff that you don't even know that it's doing it, let alone that it's something that you can stop. It's just habitual. So you don't think, oh, I'm doing catastrophic thinking. You don't even think I'm daydreaming or I'm imagining. You just do it. So once we recognize it, then you can actually pull it back. Because these things are just, they're torturous, they cause a lot of pain. And it just requires really, a lot of it requires just a little bit of education with the desire to change it. Well, that was our intro to chapter 15.
Oh, was that the topic?
No.
It wasn't chapter 18 either.
No, it wasn't 18 either. It was something just for us. For whatever reason. Let's take a moment.
60 seconds.
30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Carol, I was kind of wondering, it seems like sometimes when you're communicating with some part inside that's upset in some way, being with that part in a way that you would say if Tibby was upset.
Yeah.
You know, where there might not be so many words, but it's more soothing.
Exactly, yeah. That's right.
That's what happens for me a lot. It ends up being more that way than conversations when I try and do that.
Often it can be, yeah. And that's very helpful.
Well, how does that process work?
Just being present with your being. You know, like with, that's a good example, like with Tibby or with a little baby, you know, it's your presence, your loving presence that is so soothing.
Mm.
And maybe not words all the time, but maybe just holding.
Mm. So you don't have to figure it out every time what the pain is about?
No. It's not about figuring out.
You can have a dialogue or you can just be there.
Be present. Because it's that presence that's healing. You know, and you don't have to say, well, what's really going on? Because you're in your silent presence. You're saying that anyway. What's happening? I'm here with you. And to know that the unconscious can, and those feelings can talk. If you ask them, they'll talk. You know, they don't have to, but they can. What's really bothering you? Sometimes you'll be surprised.
Thinking about the passing of Shavaya.
Yeah.
How harrowing that sounded to be, and wondering if that story might have any relevance to what you've been saying.
Mm. What are you thinking?
I don't know. It just sounded very difficult, and
you know, I think it was very difficult, but he had set his mind and his heart to not taking any type of morphine or anything that would stop him from being fully present to that experience. And he could have had morphine at any time, but he didn't.
I know.
And he very consciously didn't, because he wanted to see it through to the end, so he was willing to go through a lot of pain and discomfort to do that. But it was a really conscious choice, and all of those things were there to relieve that if he wanted it. But he really didn't want that, you know? It was awful, but it was beautiful too.
It's beautiful too.
And he had, Uma and his brother were there, totally with him. You know? But it was hard. It was hard, but I got to see him the few days before, and that was a really wonderful experience. It's like being with such a beautiful, beautiful man, and wanting his blessings. He had that sanctity about him, so real, not a goofy thing. Like Swami, you know, when you're with Swamiji, that solid person.
Substance,
solid substance, real person. That's how Shivaya was, and it was really, really wonderful to be with him. First thing he said to me was, "It's not so bad."
Yeah. Was he comforting you then?
No, he was just. I don't. Maybe he was. I didn't take it like that, but
sounds more like he was reporting.
It was more like reporting.
Investigative.
And he talked a lot about Uma and how wonderful she was, how much to have that kind of love and care. And then he said, there's nothing really that matters but love, really. That's all. And that's the truth. You know, and we go on realizing it over and over again, but he was just totally living it in a very, very solid, very real way, and it was just great to be with him. It's really beautiful. He's a very strong person, so You went through all of the horrors of that death without, you didn't want to be unconscious. Most of us just are so loaded up on morphine that we can just slip away. And that's a lot of people die like that. And they, because the morphine will totally take away any type of pain. And you just give a little, this is how they do it. I know from my parents, they give enough. They give a little, not enough to really kill you, but more than, they gradually increase the dose so that you just slip away, really, because everything's shutting down. And then you don't have any pain. Yeah, but he was very determined that he didn't want that. He wanted to be totally present. And I said one time while they were going through this hell, as he was going so much, it was very rocky and rough. He looked at his brother and Uma just rolled his eyes. Oh my God. What is this? But it's a whole, you know, I mean, Uma was there the whole time. They were there together through this whole experience, and amazing. It's really beautiful. What's Tibby? Does she have somebody?
Edward's cutting her.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's the matter?
It's very sweet. He's treating her the way you would treat your
inner. My inner child.
Yeah.
Is my inner child.
He's the inner child.
That's beautiful to have that. It was an encounter.
Oh, Tibby. Little Tibby.
That's such a gift.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Jennifer, my roommate, I mean my next door neighbor, told me a sweet story about Tibby. Let's say if I'm gone, Edward's gone, so for the day, then Tibby will go over to Jennifer's and really talk to her. That's the only time she does if we're gone for a long time, you know. Sometimes Edward's here, I'm gone. He'll be over here working and everything's fine, but if nobody's here, I'm gone for the whole day, then she'll go over and talk to Jennifer about it. And Jennifer will say, don't worry, she'll be coming back. She'll be coming back. It's okay. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a scope.
It's really something. The truth of the, you know, the depth of the relationship, people don't realize.
Because when she's talking to Jennifer, she really means it.
I mean, oh, yeah, she means it, yeah. Did you know that that in India, they've put out a law that dolphins must legally now be treated as non-human persons.
Yeah.
Should be protected as non-human persons. And so now some of us are picking up on this term, non-human person. So whenever I sign all these petitions for the mistreatment of animals to try to stop this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so now I'm even writing little blurbs that all of this cruelty toward these non-human persons has got to stop. But I like that. They did it in India.
Yeah.
Just for dolphins. But that's the beginning.
Yeah. It opens the door.
It opens the door to viewing all beings as persons. You know, and they have to be treated as such.
So they have, like,
they have rights. The
rights of the Constitution.
Yeah. Rights to be treated with respect and with care and love. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
But I just love to see that... I mean, I was very happy to see that non-human persons.
Mm-hmm.
just heard such a very sad commentary about the way a lot of women are treated in India.
Yes. Yeah, it goes up the chain, doesn't it? Animals are the worst because they're not even viewed as beings, but then children, women, untouchables, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Did they ask the girl, who are you? And she says, nobody. I'm nobody.
Yeah. Well, you have to keep working on it.
Keep working on it, yeah.
Did your students bring that idea up, or where did you run across that concept?
Facebook. Facebook. There was actually, I have it on my page. Yeah, there was a flyer, there was a, like a little poster, but it was from India. It's just very sensitive. I was so happy to see it.
Yeah. Non-human person.
That would be very nice for here. There's a lot of people advocating for that. Legally, animals are treated as property. Like no different than a chair, a table.
Well, they are different. You know?
They are. They have feelings.
They have consciousness, and they have feelings and emotions and relationship. Much more than...
Well, Tibby was over there talking to Jennifer.
She's talking to all of us just now.
She was talking about you.
I think she's probably, careful. She's probably still getting used to the time change. It takes a while.
Yeah.
And for her, it's an hour later.
Yeah.
We're still here.